The following Dharma talk was given by Ron Hogan Green. Hogan Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. Welcome into this room. All those near and far. This afternoon, I'd like to speak to a koan from the Book of Equanimity, Case 67, the Wisdom of the Flower Garland Sutra. And the introduction to this koan says, "One speck of dust contains myriad phenomena. One thought embraces the threefold thousand worlds. Then how about a strong person who sustains the heaven and stands upon the earth? Or a wise and sharp person who understands the tale when the head is mentioned? Don't disregard your own very own spirit or bury your family treasure." The main case. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, Shakyamuni Buddha says, "As I now see all sentient beings everywhere, they're endowed with the Tathagata's wisdom and virtue. But because of deluded thoughts and attachments, they do not realize it." Now, last month I gave a talk on a koan very similar to this, case number one in Transmission of the Light, in which Shakyamuni is quoted as saying, well, the case says, "Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. And he said, 'I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way.'" This is the same, but it's got a little kicker in it. The Avatamsaka Sutra, Flower Garland Sutra, Flower Ornament Sutra, is a long sutra. When I first encountered it, it was in three books, big books, in exquisite detail. And it's highly regarded in Zen and within the Hawaiian school. And the central image in it that's brought forth through this incredible sutra, which has remarkably descriptive language, is that of Indra's net. Which is a multifaceted jewel, say a diamond with different facets in it. And in each facet reflects all the other jewels, which is the universe, every facet of every other jewel. And it's interesting because I might be wrong in this, but in this enormous sutra, it actually does not directly mention Indra's net, but everything about it is reflective of this. So the sutra speaks to the interdependency of all phenomena, all dharmas, and the progression of the Buddhist path to full enlightenment. It describes a cosmos of infinite realms upon realms upon realms, mutually containing one another. So in the introduction, one speck of dust contains myriad phenomena. One thought embraces the 3,000 worlds. So this is talking of codependent origination of these incredible reflections contained within one speck of dust, contained within you. One thought embraces 3,000 worlds. The mind is the universe itself. And this mind, your mind, is Buddha mind. When you say one speck of dust, it indicates the whole universe, subjective, objective. And it's saying that the entire phenomenal world is contained in a single grain of dust. It's the heart of the Buddha's awakening, of our awakening. So one thought embraces 3,000 words, worlds. One thought means your mind. It sounds grandiose, but it's your mind. My mind, which I am now speaking of, is like this, as is yours. That single thought contains the 3,000 worlds, which implies the entire universe. Then how about a strong person who sustains the heavens and stands upon the earth? A strong person who sustains the heavens and stands upon the earth is the same one who says, I am alone and the world honored one. There is nothing outside you. What does alone mean here? I attain the way simultaneously with all beings. Isn't that interesting? That's alone. There's only one being in this entire universe. That's the realization of the Buddha. So this is the truth about each and every one of us as it's realized. Each of us is in the heavens above, and beneath the heavens I alone am honored. The depth of your understanding of the Buddha's words depends on your experience and the intimate understanding of your body-mind. But it's fundamental. It's at the base. This is the realization and the knowing that it always has been inherent is to realize that we're simply practicing what is wholly and fully present from the beginning. Nothing needs to be added. The realization that every single being is whole and complete is the entry point to show that we relate to each other in the crucial manifestation of our practice. We are completely and totally interrelated. Or a wise and sharp person who understands the tail when the head is mentioned. That sharp and wise person understands the entirety when they see a portion of the whole. Don't disregard your very own spirit and bury your family treasure. Don't ignore this. Don't diminish it by saying, that's not me. I can't realize that. It's there. It's whole and complete as your body and mind. And anything extra you add to it, which we all do, will blur your vision, your understanding, your comprehension in the most basic sense of your original wholeness. A person, unless they've seen into their own true nature, no matter how smart they are, how clever, how articulate, how educated, unless they've seen and practiced their own true nature and lived to the best of their ability of their own true nature, is going against their own sense of their true nature. Did you hear that? And thus burying away their true treasure. They're going against their self-reflective, self-centering sense of their true nature. They're going against their thoughts about their true nature. That, to me, is very interesting. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, Shakyamuni says, as I now see all sentient beings everywhere, they're endowed with the Tathagatas, the Buddha's wisdom and virtue. But because of deluded thoughts and attachments, they don't realize it. The importance of our inherent endowment is that we can realize it. This is who we are, fundamentally. All of us, which means you personally, are endowed with your true nature and can awaken, can realize this as your essential wholeness. So that's the base of our practice. This is a given. This is what realization is. When I say realization or realize, please understand that our practice is the path to realizing this. In a sense, we know this. And yet, we tend to think of them as two separate things. The encouragement is to avoid conceptualizing the realization, but commit completely to the practice of it. And that's not easy, because we're pretty conceptually oriented people. We're trained that way. We're well trained that way. But that there's no way to get there. There's no bus or train that goes there from conceptualization. And conceptualization and realization has to pass the Buddha's test that he set up. As you may know, in his history, he worked with the best three teachers he could find of his time, and he left them all because they all pointed towards a wonderful, peaceful samadhi of great depth. Well, perhaps you've experienced that to one degree or another. And what happens next? What happens when you leave Sishin and your lover or your friend or the person in the supermarket says, where's your samadhi then? And that's what the Buddha basically said. These are mind states. And I'm looking for something that I can rely on, although I'm sure he used that kind of wording, trust. Embody is probably the right word, no matter what the circumstances are. They're good, they're bad, they're painful, they're happy, they're sad. We all know these circumstances. Where do you find yourself completely present in all of those circumstances? The sutra teaches that your mind is the universe itself. That's what Buddha mind is. When you look for this mind, the Buddha mind, you can't find it, no matter how hard you search, simply because you're looking outside yourself. When you look for your breath as a thing, you can't find it. And yet everyone here can experience their breath at moments, or many moments, or each breath. So there's ultimately, at bottom, nothing outside you. Mu's an example of that. People work on Mu, and they bring in the universe, but from a very outside perspective. But being Mu, you don't bring in anything. There's only Mu. And so it becomes not a problem to express it. Mu is expressing Mu, of course. Because all beings, all of reality, are this mind, each one of us. And each one of us uniquely reflects every other being at once. We are wholly entwined with each other. Not just people, of course, but let's start there. We're reflecting them in all of our thoughts and words. It's unavoidable. This is Buddha mind, no mind, as we practice and realize it. So what is the realization of Buddha mind? What is that? We speak of it. Clarity, thusness, awakened mind. Yet it cannot be spoken of. Not fundamentally. It cannot be understood. Not fundamentally. It cannot be grasped because it is not a thing. Just thinking of a simile, if you're in the middle of an ocean, and you want to hold on to that ocean, all of it, well, in one sense you are, because it's all right there, and yet it reaches everywhere. You can't grasp it. Now, there are live words and dead words, but they're pointing. Those live words are not the actual realization of your own mind. They certainly help, and they're pointing, and they're bringing it alive in us. And it's pretty distinguishable, I think, after a while, when words are alive or dead. So when we speak of it, every perspective is self-referential. Yet we must speak and act and come forth in this dualistic world. We don't wait for some calibrated sense of measured reference of our insight. Coming forth to help beings is the Bodhisattva vow, alive in the reality of your life. That's what this practice is for, simply that. But the realization of our true nature is not self-reflective. So can we realize our true mind? Can we? Of course. Of course. Of course we can. It's the whole point that we can. Is that realization something, something measurable, something that we can hold on or pin to my chest? No. No. Ultimately, we can't know anything about it. We can only embody it. And this realization is not ever a cookbook practice. The practice is a path. Yet it is a path only you can walk, you, in your individual life and individual karma. There's no one else who can walk it for you. Only you can walk it in your particular way. As I now see all sentient beings everywhere, they're endowed with the Tathagata's wisdom and virtue. All of us. But because of deluded thoughts and attachments, they do not realize it. Hojin Sensei spoke last night of harmony, harmony of the Sangha, harmony of our practice, harmony of our life, in relation to the precepts. But you realize it wasn't speaking in relation to the precepts. She was speaking to you, about your practice. We're all practicing to the best of our ability our deluded thoughts and attachments. And this practice is the awakening of our wisdom and virtue. Connect those two. Within our delusion, within our suffering, the practice of that is the awakening of our wisdom and virtue and harmony. That's the only way you can get there. Get there, of course, there's no getting there. But so forgive my lack of ability to express it. And we all live within certain habits and patterns, many of which are so ingrained, we don't even realize how they can so subtly cultivate harm for ourselves and distance for others. Because they work. Provisionally, they work for us. They got us here. And they got us here because in these patterns and habits, inherently, there's a distance from our life. They're the same thing. The habits and patterns are distancing from the bare bones of our life, the rawness of our life. And so usually they act, we think, to protect us. But of course, in protecting us, they create harm for ourselves, and therefore we create it for others. I don't want to feel suffering. I'll give it to you. Is that okay? That's what we do. We may not think of it that way, but that's what we do. And sometimes they're incredibly subtle. And so the harmony of the Sangha is a mirror. When within that harmony there's disharmony, that's you and I creating that. We get to see it because we're practicing. How wonderful. How great. Disharmony in the Sangha. Isn't that wonderful? That's how you wake up. You don't want to do that. You don't want to cause that, hopefully. So you take a look at it. Ain't easy. You're probably 3/4 or more blind to it, but it's being reflected back to you. And actually, from a certain viewpoint, everybody and everything you meet is that Sangha, reflecting back to you, your actions, your thoughts, your words. And we shape ourselves, define ourselves, identify through these ways of responding to what comes our way, right? So often in these ways, we're backing up step by step by step away from being intimate with ourselves, away from being intimate with others. Sometimes even in the name of intimacy or the name of practice. And so we have taught ourselves to carefully measure our intimacy, to protect ourselves, to cradle our fears and the safety of our accustomed patterns. And then they have a provisional safety. We're familiar with them. And it's not that uncommon for people to run internally screaming from this practice because they don't want to face that or can't face it or it isn't the right time to face it. Shishin Wick, who's a Dharma brother to Daito Roshi and a friend, tells the story of a practitioner who carries a sack of horseshit with him and visits varying training centers and centers. And wherever he goes, he puts down the sack and then pauses and says, I'm not staying here, it smells like shit. So he picks up his sack and off he goes. Familiar? Thank you, Shishin. So I want to explore today and also tomorrow, hint, hint. But because of deluded thoughts and attachments, we do not realize it. And I'm going to use a contemporary poem by David Ignatow, who's, from what I can read, has died, a sensitive and dedicated 20th century American poet. And I love doing this, as you may know, because here in this talk and tomorrow, we're connecting the Buddha from India to here, to our culture. So the poem is called Listening. You wept in your mother's arms, and I knew that from then on I was to forget myself. Listening to your sobs, I was resolved against my will to do well by us. And so I said, without thinking, in great panic, to do wrong in one's judgment, though others thrive by it, is the right road to blessedness. Not to submit to error is in itself wrong and pride. Standing beside you, I took an oath to make your life simpler by complicating mine. And what I always thought would happen did. I was lifted up in joy. Now, I don't know, but I suspect this was a love poem to his lover. And I want to take it up with all of us. I don't know what his relationship, if any, with the Dharma was, but there's some words in there that ring bells. So I want to open it a bit. The poem is deeply personal. Your journey is deeply personal. It points to something essential that we all face in walking this path. The question of what it means to commit to a selfless life for the sake of all beings. What it actually means in the nitty-gritty sense. So, you wept in your mother's arms. Now, I have never wept in my stepmother's arms. It wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have been appropriate. The thought would have never crossed my mind and never have crossed her mind. But you see her over there? I've wept in her arms. The mother of all Buddhas. The mother of the personification of wisdom, your wisdom. And, you know, in a way, this poem is like a dream, in that when you have a dream, perhaps you're aware that every person in the dream is a slice of you. That's you. Not in the entirety, but in a reflection back to you. I wept in my mother's arms, and I knew that from then on I was to forget myself. One consequence of our practice is a deep, deep realization of the subtlety and profundity of the First Noble Truth. It's usually not the first take, life of suffering, it sucks, okay. It's not quite that. Doesn't exclude that, but that's kind of a superficial understanding of it. Another deeper understanding, not the deepest, but a deeper understanding, is that the suffering is from lack of intimacy from ourself and others, which may not appear as suffering to the outside eye or to your eye. We're just going about our business. But the hallmark of suffering is it creates karma, which inevitably creates more suffering. The way I understand this fundamental teaching of the Buddha is that there is endless suffering around us and in us, and everywhere we look. And when I start to look, I can see it. And if you do any amount of zazen, it doesn't take long for you to, oh my God, that is my mind? I can't stand myself. And yet that is your mind. We are capable of thinking anything, and I do mean anything in zazen, and you get a chance to see that. And it's been there all along, but we haven't looked. Why? Who would want to look at that? And of course, the Buddha didn't stop with number one. He went on to say why. He went on to say, it doesn't have to be that way. And he went on to say, here's how. It doesn't have to be that way. And that's what we're doing to the best of our ability here. And understanding that in a personal way can inspire us and drive us to seek a path to help ourselves and others in this endless suffering, which has not changed from the time of the Buddha till now, before the Buddha, and isn't going to change tomorrow. There's a lot here in how the Buddha defines suffering, both karmically and in detail, without confusing the inevitable pains of sickness, old age, and death. That's a given. But that's not really what he was referring to, although that can include suffering or not include suffering. One way we distance ourselves from the reality of our thoughts and words and actions, resulting in a lack of intimate connection, is that we're distancing ourselves from ourselves. We know we're missing something. Something is missing from our life, but we haven't a clue what to do about it. Or maybe we do, and you're here. When we cannot relate to the subtle ways we suffer, then intimate connection with ourselves, with other beings who suffer subtly and pervasively, results in vague conception and ideas about ourselves and others. It's vague. We really don't see clearly what's going on. But note what can happen when we don't protect ourselves with our accustomed distance. From then on, I was to forget myself. And I really wonder what his connection with the Dharma is when you hear words like that. Because those are not casual words. He saw suffering. He saw suffering for the poem in someone else. But he realized it was in him. And from then on, he vowed to forget himself. So here it is. This resolve, from then on, it was crystal clear to him. It's not a casual intent. It is a vow. Listening to your sobs, I was resolved against my will to do well by us. Does that sound familiar? Anything you've encountered before? I was resolved to do well by us. Against my will, you know. I don't particularly want to do this. I just have to do it. Not casual. And this is the crux of our practice. The tension of who we think we are, think of because of deluded thoughts and attachments, we do not realize it. That. And what you and I may need to do to uphold our vows in our life. It's going to be a tension. And notice what comes from listening to the sobs of others, or perhaps your sobs. After all, this poem is entitled Listening. And I don't think he was talking about, oh, I hear. This is a different kind of listening. And so I said, without thinking, in great panic, to do wrong in one's own judgment, though others thrive by it, is the right road to blessedness. I said that earlier. To do wrong in one's own judgment, to go against one's own judgment, because we think, fill in the blanks, though others thrive by it, is the right road to blessedness. And why in great panic? Is it because at some level we are acknowledging what is at stake for us? Our life and so many lives? How important is this to us? I said, a wise person, any person actually, unless they have seen into their own true nature, practice their own true nature, live out of their own true nature, is going against their own sense of their true nature, their own ideas about it, projections about it, how they should be, how you should be. I know really well how you should be, don't we? And this is a key point. And thus in doing that, burying away their true treasure. To do wrong in one's own judgment is to go against the grain of all our concentrated, self-centered desires. which is concerned. What is it concerned with? Me. Mine. My feelings. Oh, you hurt me. There's no forgiving that. Even if I say, I forgive you. Even if you say, I'm sorry. There's no forgiving that. To go against all of our satisfactions, our desires, our likes, our dislikes, which maintain our contact with the wheel of samsara, with the life of samsara, and the endless perpetuation of our ignorance by grasping, endless wanting. And this is though, even though others thrive by it, right? We live in a world where others are thriving, making money, getting power, manipulating the system so that only the selected few get what they want, what they think they want. To go against the grain of our ignorance and desires, to acknowledge that, is the right road to blessedness. And the poem goes on, not to submit to error is in itself wrong and pride. Not to acknowledge that. You know this. You know what's right or wrong in your heart. When you sit there long enough, you know the wrong you did or the right you did. This is hard. Zazen is hard. This path is hard. Coming face to face with our errors and our pride. Blinded as we are by our own ignorance of the truth. Standing beside you, I took an oath to make your life simpler by complicating mine. Do you understand what that means, what that implies? That's the Bodhisattva path, right there. Standing beside you. Actually, we are standing beside each other. And when we realize just how close that is, how entwined that is, we can take this oath, we will take this oath in that realization to make your life simpler, better, by complicating mine. That's the oath of a Bodhisattva. And as a natural response to your pain, before I honor mine, that's what comes out of that. And what I always thought would happen did. I was lifted up in joy. It's amazing what happens when you give yourself away. I thought if I gave myself away, I wouldn't get anything back. And it turns out, you get everything back. That's the point of this practice. It's all yours. It's always been all yours. True, true love.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.